Okay. Any preliminary comments, questions? I assume everybody received their exam. No? Then Suzanne upstairs has them. Sue Baraka has them for you to pick up. Any questions about methodology or? Okay. All right. We left off last class yesterday, having talked generally about the way that wrongful death recoveries are structured, in particular the way in which legislatures choose the form of recovery and the structure, the contents of that recovery. I hope I included in the version of the textbook that you're working from, at the very end of Chapter 3, there's some material that actually belongs in this section, and I hope there's a cross-reference to that. I'm not exactly sure how all this turned out. What's that? Yes, no? Anyway, there's... let me just give you kind of the history, the background of this addition to the California statute. You may have heard about this case that was in California, a woman who was mauled to death by a dog. I think it was a Rottweiler or some other large dog. But she was coming out of her apartment, I believe, and this dog attacked her, and she died from the injuries. There was a criminal trial that was widely publicized about 3 years ago. I'm trying to remember the name of the plaintiff or the defendants. Anybody remember the name? Yeah. It's in San Francisco, and the trial actually took place in San Diego, as I recall, just because of the publicity. They changed the venue on it. But the end of the case resulted in a conviction of the owners of the dog for criminal negligence. I think it might have been manslaughter, actually, in the death of this woman. Well, the woman who died had a domestic partner who tried to sue for wrongful death, sue these same defendants, to obtain a civil recovery, filed a civil action against those defendants seeking a recovery. At the time she filed the lawsuit, the law in California, the statute, the wrongful death statute, essentially said, you know, for wrongful death, the following parties can be compensated: spouse, children, you know, if there are no spouse or children, then the parents or siblings. However, the statute was written, and so the domestic partner of the decedent filed her claim, and when the defendant says, well, you're not on this list, she said, well, I should be on this list. It's unconstitutional to exclude me just because I don't fall under the traditional form of being a spouse for purposes of meaningful compensation. I should be considered in the same category. As it turns out, the trial judge, I believe the case was filed in San Francisco, the trial judge agreed with her and said, yes, discriminating against you because you were homosexual, the relationship wasn't recognized as marriage by the law, that's a form of discrimination. It's unconstitutional. The statute, by excluding you, is unconstitutional. I think you're qualified. Well, of course, there was quite a bit of controversy about this decision. Many people thought that the courts of appeal would say, well, maybe the statute's maybe this form of discrimination is wrong. Maybe it's even unconstitutional. but that doesn't mean you can amend the statute and add somebody to its list. Well, before the case was ever heard, a bill was presented in the legislature, which was eventually passed by the legislature and then signed, as you see in the materials here, by, the late Gray Davis. And there you have it. Now, obviously, this is an issue about which people will have sharply differing views as to whether or not this is an improvement in the law or a regression in the law. Should people like the plaintiff in that case be entitled to a wrongful death recovery? We'll encounter many of the same questions later on when we come to the section on related parties and claims for loss of consortium or bystander injuries. In these cases, or just so you see the comparison, in these cases someone is saying, I've been injured because you negligently caused the death of this person to whom I was closely related. And later on, we will have, for example, Marianne Rodriguez filing a claim for loss of consortium saying, you dropped a 600-pound pipe on my husband, Richard. And, of course, he's entitled to claim damages, but I want to make it clear that you dropped a 600-pound pipe on our marriage. And, therefore, I, as part of that marriage, was victimized as well. I was injured by your negligence, and I have a right to recover for my injury. And the court, in that case, has to decide, is there a separate claim for loss of consortium? And if there is, what, again, are the boundaries of this? So, again, I'm suggesting, pointing out, that in each of these areas where someone says, I had a relationship with either the decedent or with this person who suffered a spinal cord injury, and I need to be compensated for the injury that I suffered because of my close relationship to that person, the law has to decide, okay, what counts? Which relationships entitle you to a place in the line forming at the cashier's window, the line forming in front of the jury to say, I want my turn to explain to the jury how I've been injured, and I want them to have the chance to compensate me. And how do we define the point at which we say, sorry, like waiting in line at Costco or wherever, and they say, this register is closed. You know, in effect, this is the last person we're going to serve here, and you can't get in line. You don't qualify. Now, again, everybody has their standards. No one is going to suggest that everyone, regardless of the, that essentially everybody gets to take their turn and try their hand in front of the jury. So that if I show up and say, for example, in the case of Kenneth Rice, gee, he and I were on a high school lacrosse team together, and I spent Thanksgiving at his parents' house one time, and we've kept in regular email touch ever since. And when I found out he was killed in this plane crash, I really grieved over that. Here's my bill. People say, "Huh? Who are you? Get over it." And in a similar way, you can see the way in which a relationship short of marriage could be, for example, what about somebody who's a week before their wedding? They've been engaged for 10 months. They're a week away from the wedding, and I'm sure there was somebody in the World Trade Center who was in that condition. Does the fiancé, a week short of the marriage, qualify for an award, or do we say, no, I'm sorry, you're not a parent, you're not a child, you're not a sibling, We don't have, fiancés aren't in our guest list here. You don't qualify. If the fiancé qualifies, well, what about people who are a week away from getting engaged? He'd proposed, she'd accepted, they were going to have celebration at Thanksgiving when all the relatives were there, and they were going to announce their engagement. Not engaged yet, but, you know. So again, they were dating. They're real serious. I mean, where, again, does the law say you qualify, you don't? One solution to the problem would be, in effect, to say it doesn't matter. Let them all, I hope I don't have the wrong character here, the Deacon Jones character. You know, I go through the backfield and tackle everybody till I find the guy with the ball. You know, we could essentially say parade everybody before the jury and let the jury be the gatekeeper. Don't have an artificial gatekeeper. It's up to the jury to separate the people who truly deserve a recovery from those who are told, in effect, I'm sorry, you don't qualify. So, again, I guess my thought experiment for you is, suppose you are a member of the California legislature or some other body, and there are no cases you're required to follow. It's only up to you in making public policy. How would you define the scope of the beneficiaries entitled to recover for wrongful death? It's not an easy question to answer. And one of the reasons why I want you to think about that is because as you look at statutes already in existence and you see a statute that appears to produce an unjust result, it allows a recovery to somebody you would put lower on the guest list, and it denies recovery to somebody you would place higher on the guest list. Remind yourself that it's not as though we can compare this bad statute to a perfect statute, a really good statute. They all suffer from significant anomalies and imperfections. Either you err on the side of generosity and include a very wide variety of claims at the risk of this long parade of people, which is unmanageable, or you draw bright lines and say, here's the list, it's a short one, but these are the ones that qualify, and that's it. Or you have a system in which you put a huge burden on the trial judge to say it's quality relationships that count, or something like that. So, again, it's a problem, legislatures have to wrestle with it to try to figure out what is the best balance of competing considerations. Questions about wrongful death. Okay, well then let's pick up with our next, we're out of the frying pan into the fire here, in terms of controversy, because the next area is involves some extremely delicate issues about which people tend to feel rather strongly, and where the tort system, as we'll see, runs a very significant risk of trampling over these delicate things with its hobnail boots. But before we get into all of that sort of policy complexity, I want to first identify the unique aspect of these kinds of claims and make sure we're not inadvertently including what I would call a garden variety or ordinary case. The so-called wrongful birth or wrongful life cases arise when a defendant's negligence causes the birth of a child who would otherwise not have been born. it does not include cases in which the defendant's negligence causes injury to a child. Let's suppose, for example, a doctor is not paying attention while a mother in labor is about to deliver a child, and the fetal heart monitor shows that the baby is in distress, needs, you know, to be taken care of, or otherwise there's going to be a lack of oxygen to the brain. The doctor, the nurse isn't paying attention. Baby is born with significant brain damage. Is that a wrongful birth case? No. Wrongful life case? No. Why? Because the birth of the child was not caused by the doctor's negligence. Is it easy to fix the compensation for a child born with significant brain damage? Some refer to very disrespectfully, I might add, as bad baby cases. They're referred to as bad baby cases because they tend to be an identifiable group, birth trauma kinds of cases, significant, you know, physical, mental damages, maybe very large dollar value. But again, they're not wrongful birth or wrongful life. What makes wrongful birth and wrongful life cases difficult is, as I said, that the defendant's negligence, as in the first case we look at, a failed sterilization procedure. The defendant was supposed to do something that would prevent the birth of children. The defendant did it negligently. Result, child is born. Now, we then confront all of these difficult policy, philosophical, moral, legal questions about how do we measure the damages in a case like that. But at least we're all on board identifying that's the kind of case we have. Again, as distinguished from a case that sounds like it, for example, in the Harbison case, it sounds like a case in which the mother gets pregnant, the defendant negligently supplies a drug that causes injury to the child. You sue the drug company or the doctor for causing the child to have future problems, but that wouldn't be a wrongful birth case. What's unique about Harbison is the allegation against the defendant is if you hadn't been negligent, these children would not have been born. So again, getting that straight, making sure you're on the right page in terms of whether we get into all this wrongful birth stuff, is the first step as distinguished from the ordinary kind of case, what I would call a garden variety case, where the defendant's negligence causes a child to suffer some kind of injury. I understand, and the distinction in the term, some people try to identify different stages at which the negligence takes place. So that, for example, some people say there's a distinction between a wrongful conception case, where because of the defendant's negligence, a child is conceived who would otherwise not have been conceived, as distinguished from a wrongful birth case in which, well, the kid was already conceived, but it wouldn't have been born but for the doctor's negligence. For example, where the plaintiff says, I would have had an abortion if you had properly diagnosed my condition and had explained to me what my options are. Now, again, I would consider all of those cases, I don't distinguish between wrongful conception, wrongful pregnancy, wrongful birth. All of those, to me, are the same from the standpoint that what's difficult about them is that we have to decide whether the birth, as in the Arizona Health Sciences Center case, whether the birth of a healthy child can be, as a matter of law, a source of damage to the parents. That's the tough question. And exactly whose negligence is involved at what stage is, to me, sort of a secondary problem. Now, as we'll talk about in at some point here, there's also the question, the idea, we'll particularly talk about it in the Harbison case, the idea of mitigating damages when the parent discovers that, contrary to what they had paid for, expected from the defendant, they now find themselves expecting a child, whether or not they have some kind of a duty by adoption or abortion to avoid the harm. That's a problem, an issue, but it's distinctly secondary in my view for this reason, that even if you considered adoption or abortion to be something a reasonably prudent person would do in response to an unwanted pregnancy, you still have the plaintiff can say, in effect, I've still been damaged by being forced to go through that process. If the defendant negligently put me in a position where my best option was adoption or abortion, there ought to be some compensation for that. The only thing that would change would be whether or not you reduce the amount of damages the plaintiff is entitled to by saying, well, yes, you're entitled to some damages, but we're going to reduce that because you failed to take measures for your own safety. And again, that launches us into the issue about whether a jury could determine whether a reasonable person would have an abortion. I mean, I'm not sure exactly how a jury would go about deciding that. So if the defendant's argument is, well, yeah, through our negligence, the plaintiff got pregnant, but it was her duty exercising reasonable care to give the child up for adoption or to have an abortion, and then the jury says, yeah, what do we think? What do we think a reasonable person would have done in that situation? The jury's going to have a much tougher time resolving that issue than resolving, they're going to have a tough time with any of these issues, as we'll see. Go ahead. Why don't we wait till we get into the middle of the Arizona Health Sciences Center case before we get into the details of that, because it's a very important question about how we measure the damages. But I wanted to sort of set the table here first so we understand what is distinct and unique about wrongful birth, wrongful life. Why is there a separate section devoted to that as compared to why doesn't it fall along with other kinds of similar injuries? Well, there really isn't any similar injury to this one, and it poses these unique public policy questions that the court has to answer. So why don't we start and just put Mr. Cafferty? Well, see, that there again, suppose the parents say, and again, some of this triggers all of the, you know, moral philosophical questions that where we disagree within our society about what's right and what's wrong, and putting this to a jury to have 12 people essentially resolve those things which are highly contentious, highly personal, and so forth. But even from a pro-choice perspective, the availability of abortion doesn't mean that it's cost-free. So the person could say, in effect, yes, I had an abortion, but it was necessitated by the defendant's negligence. The defendant improperly performed the sterilization procedure or didn't properly formulate this contraceptive medication I was taking, or prescribed the wrong thing, or what have you. Somebody's negligence resulted in my getting pregnant. The best thing for me, it seemed like, was having an abortion, but let me tell you, that was no fun. And here are all the damages that I suffered from having that. And again, you put that before a jury and have them figure out, okay, the defendant is responsible for this much. So, and again, and let me just say we're getting ahead of ourselves in terms of what Chapter 5 talks about. Chapter 5 on contributory fault talks about the plaintiff's responsibility to use reasonable care for their own protection, for their own safety. But if, for example, I'm injured in a way and I have to take some kind of, I have options. Let's suppose my arm gets badly mangled and one of my options is amputation and the other option is to try to save the arm, although it poses a substantial risk of infection and so forth. I have a difficult choice to make, one of which foregoes that I would ever have an arm. And the other is, I try to save my arm, but I have all kinds of risks and problems associated with that. You can't blame me if in 2020 hindsight you say, oh, as it turns out, it would have been better if you had done this other thing. I'm only obligated to use reasonable care. And if I do what seems right to me at the time, and presumably when a couple is deciding upon, you know, continuing pregnancy or adoption or abortion, presumably they're trying to make the best decision for them and for their family. It seems kind of crummy for the defendant to say, hey, you should have thought about me. I had a right to be part of that decision-making process, and you picked the option that put me at the greatest disadvantage. But again, why don't we start with Arizona Health Sciences, and then we'll kind of work in some of these problems here. Can somebody tell us about the facts and the basic decision of the court? Go ahead. It's Mr. Edwards, right? And again, procedurally, this is against the this is a motion for mandamus or for prohibition. That's the reason why the Superior Court is the defendant, because they're trying to get this dismissed. Okay. Okay, now again, if this were a case in which in the course of this procedure, this medical procedure, the doctor had negligently given too much anesthetic or had, you know, caused an infection or had done something else, there are no theoretical problems with it, negligence, causation, damages, and so forth. As you say, the reason this is in Chapter 3 is not that there are any problems with negligence or causation, it's all with the measure of damages. And so the plaintiffs say, in effect, we paid good money and the husband in particular underwent some degree of discomfort, to achieve a particular result, and the doctor failed in that. And we've been damaged by having a child that we could not afford. What's the defendant's answer to that complaint? Okay, but give me in short summary, what does the defendant say in answer to the claim, you owe us compensation because we now have to raise this kid we were trying to avoid? There's a little more cheerful version of that. The defendants want to try to be a little more upbeat than that. So give me the version again, the upbeat version of their response. That's a legal position, but what's their pitch? Ms. McLaughlin? Yeah, rejoice and be exceeding glad, you know. You have this happy, healthy kid. So... again, legally, we have to figure out, well, is that an adequate response? The plaintiffs say, that's a nice, pious thing for you to say, but after all, we're the ones who, as I said before, tried very hard to avoid this because we didn't think it was going to be such a grand idea. Okay, now, as it turns out, we essentially have three options here, as the court lays out, sort of door number one, door number two, door number three, and they each represent a different way to handle the question. What's our option number one, which is the one the defendants prefer? Okay, so one option is to say, the defendant says, don't think of us as being completely heartless here. We'll pay for the expense, the inconvenience, the wage loss, even the pain and suffering of childbirth. But after all, from that point on, if the child turns out to be normal and healthy, you've suffered a benefit rather than a loss, so we shouldn't be liable for anything beyond that point. Door number two that we could choose as a rule here is what? Right. We start making a list, you know. 600 small huggies, 500 medium, 400 large, 18 pairs of Oshkosh Bagosh jeans, one high chair, this many trips to the counselor, one trip to juvenile hall at 2 in the morning, prom dress, et cetera. Okay. As Zorba the Greek would say, the whole catastrophe. We just make a list of all that, and we say this is what the plaintiff has to fork over now because of the defendant's negligence. That's door number two, and of course the plaintiff would be happy to get all of that. What's door number three? Yeah, so... essentially, as you may have seen, I forgot to erase this before I left, you just set up a ledger here. And you make a list of all those things that I listed off before. What goes into the, having a child for a family like this? Now, again, it's going to be different. Every family is going to be different if the couple is unmarried or if it's their only child and they're planning to have no children at all and because of the defendant's negligence, they now have a child. There are all kinds of different variations. What if the parents had health issues or what have you? What goes on to the debit side will vary from family to family, and then, of course, offsetting it will be whatever this blessing here. Well, the plaintiff's argument is essentially, I went to you, doctor, or pharmaceutical company, or whoever the defendant is who negligently delivered or failed to deliver the services that were supposed to prevent pregnancy. The plaintiff says, I went to you depending upon your expertise, your skill, and so forth, to avoid this consequence. I have my own reasons for wanting to avoid the consequence. That's not for you to decide. That's for me to decide. And when you fail to deliver it, why are you any less liable for the injury that you've caused me as if you'd caused an infection or you'd, hurt me in some other way? Okay, right. Now again, I want to make sure we understand the similarity between cases like this and other cases we handle. Suppose, again, the defendant's negligence results in a big scar across my face, and it's disfiguring, it's painful, and going through life with this condition involves a lot of embarrassment, pain, suffering, and so forth. That's all touchy-feely stuff. The plaintiff, in asking the jury for compensation, not only for economic loss, for medical expense, but for the pain and suffering of going through life like that, the jury has to consider, how much compensation is due to someone who has to endure this. In what respect, if any, is it different for the plaintiff in this case to say, here's a list, and those of us who are parents know that it's a pretty long list of the things that you sacrifice to raise a child. Why is this case any different from asking for compensation because I've had a big scar across my face? Now, let's talk about door number three here. What's the dissent's problem with using this approach? Ms. McLaughlin? Okay. In what respect? Okay, the phrase that's used by the dissent is that you're going to turn the kid into an emotional bastard. I want to make sure that's different from what we're trying to do to you. They mean this in the literal sense, namely that the child will be separated from, in effect, made an orphan, or the parental bond will be cut off. That is, the child will find out my parents didn't really want me. Now, I hesitate, but not very long, in getting personal at this point, that my parents didn't plan for me. Quite the opposite. And yet here I am. Now, does that explain a lot about me? That, you know, this is the point the dissent is making. Once you find out your parents tried to avoid your conception, that you're going to turn into a basket case, well, as I say, that may explain a lot in my case. But that, I don't think by itself is so surprising because, quite frankly, it's quite common. Many of us are here as a result not of a doctor's negligence or a pharmaceutical company's negligence, but through a more common form of negligence. So, you know, and most of us have managed to survive that knowledge without completely going to pieces. But there's actually something worse that's going on here. It's not just that you find out that your parents tried to avoid your birth. In my case, I might add that my oldest brother was four and 4 months when I was born, and there were two older brothers in between. So I understand my mother's desire to wait a little while maybe before having another child. But again, does that knowledge by itself cause harm, or is there something else going on? What is the dissent concerned about here? What's going to happen if we permit this kind of methodology? What do the parents have to do in order to get a recovery here? What's that? Well, it's the question of whether we're forcing them to get an abortion or an adoption. But even if they could, even if we don't force that upon them, even if we say, hey, look, it's your choice. If you choose to keep the child, the defendant can't complain that your solution to the problem. I mean, again, suppose the plaintiff says, gee, under the pressure of circumstances, I had an abortion. It's 5 years later now. I'm still suffering from it. I want to sue the doctor for compensation. Again, that would be a worse case for us, I would think, to try to adjudicate and evaluate than one in which the doctor is forced to put up with the fact that they decided to have this kid. But, yeah. Okay. And you don't help them. I mean, again, as you put it, the problem is not just that the parents acknowledge to the kid we didn't plan it this way, but I suspect most of us, once we arrived, our parents had a different attitude about it than before we arrived. So at least we would encourage parents to make the best of the situation. Whereas under this methodology, in order to preserve the tort claim, the parent has to stubbornly maintain, I'm still mad. I haven't gotten over it. I haven't made the best of it. It's still not worth it. He or she is still, they are still more trouble than they are worth. And by conditioning the parents' ability to recover damages on continuing to badmouth their own kid, in effect, that seems like a perverse incentive for the court to be forcing upon the parents. That's the concern of the dissent. Lest we think that it's an easy case here, remember that what the parents might say is, look, I don't particularly enjoy this process either, but I'll tell you what, I'm going to have a much better attitude toward Junior if we have a little money in the bank. The reason we were trying not to have Junior was we couldn't afford it. If through this lawsuit we put some money in the bank so we can get a bigger house or get some help, you know, with the kids and so forth, then that would cheer us up enormously. So, oh, you pious defendants over here that want to keep us from using this method of compensation, you're actually standing in the way of the parents actually valuing this child. You know, who's really being child-friendly in this? Is it the defendants who want to restrict the recovery? Is it the plaintiffs who want a full recovery without any consideration of an offsetting benefit? Is it the court that wants to do this split the baby, so to speak, in which it allows for a recovery but then offsets it by the benefit? I don't really like any of these choices here. So, again, the difficulty is, how do we craft a rule in dealing with cases like this? And it's not like this is some far-fetched, implausible, once-in-a-blue-moon kind of a case. You can imagine that there are quite a few cases in which negligence of various kinds results in pregnancy and birth. How should we handle cases like that? Okay, but
why not just say, okay, fine, we'll compensate you for the fact that you had to go through this pregnancy, but help yourself out here. You don't want the child to get somebody to do it.
Well, but realistically, if I have a child who's 6 and a child who's 4, my wife gets pregnant, we go through the pregnancy, you know, baby's born, I say, oh, we gave that one up for adoption. I mean, I don't think so. I don't see that as a realistic answer to the wrong that the defendant did. Now, it could be that as a matter of public policy, we are so offended by option number 3 that we prefer the statement as a society, look, there have to be other ways of helping couples who have, you know, financial needs in raising their children. As a society, we have an obligation to deal with that, but the way to do it is not through the tort system. But on the other hand, to the extent that the plaintiffs, to the extent that the plaintiffs are saying your negligence caused my injury, and the defendants say, in effect, well, you haven't really been injured, that doesn't quite ring true. Now, again, it may be that the process of compensating the plaintiff shouldn't do more harm than good, and wait, it gets worse. When we get into Harbison, we're in even more, I would say, dangerous area in which our attempt to do good may wind up inadvertently harming something else that's really important to us. We have to be very conscious of where we tread here. But again, none of these rules is particularly satisfactory. And in this respect, it's like the wrongful death remedies, in which you're kind of stuck with some pretty lousy choices. Which of them you wind up adopting, so to speak, turns out to be something which is in effect the best of a bad situation. Now, as I say, tomorrow we're going to pick up with Harbison, which poses even more difficulty, and I want to anticipate Harbison by again returning to this idea of figuring out what's different about Harbison compared to an ordinary case in which, like the Sindel cases, somebody in utero gets harmed by a medication that's hazardous to them. But we'll pick that up tomorrow.
I don't want to jump too far ahead. When you talk about the harvest of
faith, yes.
You got a wrongful birth there.
Yes.
Obviously, there's a problem with the baby.
Right.
Do you have a separate cause of action for negligence for the damage to the babies in addition to the negligence that they were born?
Well, see, there's the wrongful birth claim that's brought by the parents. The parents say, we've been harmed. There's also a wrongful...